This is the Mind and Fitness Podcast. It is Wednesday, January the 9th, and we are back on the normal schedule. Thanks so much for bearing with me over the last couple of weeks as the show has been launched on Thursdays, mostly because of the holidays, and I do hope that everybody had a great holiday. Christmas and New Year's, it was awesome. It's always a good time hanging out with the fam and the girls and my sweet Audrey. My one-year-old is turning, or she is turning one this Saturday. So we're prepping up for that. I'm actually sitting in basically a little kid birthday party decoration hell right now as I look across the table. My wife's doing a killer job. So the whole theme of it is Audrey's winter wonderland. So there's a lot of snowflakes that are cut out and different winter themes. So it's super cute stuff. It's going to be really nice. So I can't believe that our second and I would imagine last child is now going to be one. It's just pretty wild. So thanks so much for tuning into the podcast over the last few months. There's been so much great growth. And I want to start off again, as I always do, by inviting you to join us on Patreon. Patreon is a place for creators where you can go on and basically make a monetary donation/purchase to be closer to the Mind and Fitness Podcast. So it's Patreon, patreon.com/ the Mind and Fitness Podcast. And there's three different levels. For $8 a month, you're basically pledging a thank you. Thank you, Eddie, for investing your time and your energy and your resources and the money that you've put into the equipment and how much it costs to host the podcast and kind of all this stuff. More or less a thank you and a shout out on the show. And the next level up is $25, which would give you a couple of bonus shows per month. And what I do is a Q&A on the Patreon page. Only patrons can see it, where you can essentially email me questions that you would want answered on that specific episode. And again, it's only for members. They're the only ones that would be able to see it. So it's a video show, interactive. It's pretty cool. And then there's a $75 level that I'm offering up to do a 45-minute consult essentially with me if you want to essentially ask me anything or you feel like you're stuck or, you know, whatever the case is. So initially, let me throw out some love to Helen, Arnie, Barb, and Kim, all being patrons of the show. I appreciate your help in helping make the Patreon campaign even better. And then I also want to throw you over to iTunes. So if you are listening on an Apple device, iDevice, iPad, iPod, if that's still a thing, and iPhone, and on a Mac, you can go to iTunes and tap write a review, give it 5 stars, write out what you think of it if you like what it is that you hear, if you feel like it's giving you value. So from there, you know, the last couple of shows have been solo shows, and there was when I started doing this podcast and I discovered Dr. Sarno's work, there was one person that I had on my big dream list of psychologists. I first saw her in the trailer for All the Rage, and that's Dr. Arlene Feinblatt out of New York. And she actually is probably the most well-known of the referring psychotherapists that Dr. Sarno worked with. If you go to her website, you can find, you see pictures of her and Dr. Sarno interacting. She's very, very smart, very, very to the point. So her and actually Dr. Eric Sherman, who's also a well-known referring psychotherapist for Dr. Sarno, he is a part of this as well. So it's kind of a two-on-one type of a thing. I think that you're really, really, really going to like it. It's packed full of information, things that you can do right now to help alleviate yourself, get yourself out of pain. So I'm going to leave you with that. This is an incredibly short introduction. I will say that recently I put a pretty polarizing comment post on my Instagram that got some love and some heat from people and talking about chronic pain being a result of repressed emotions. And I think I'm going to go deeper into that next week. We'll talk a little bit more about that. But yeah, there's still interviews that are in the can. I've got a great success story that I'm going to be doing an interview for this coming Friday from somebody. So just a lot of good stuff is upcoming on the show. So again, head over to Facebook, give us a like at the Mind and Fitness Podcast. Shoot me a message if you have any questions. I'm here to help you guys. I'm happy to talk to you. I love getting DMs from people. So again, this is Dr. Eric Sherman and Dr. Arlene Feinblatt. This is the Mind and Fitness Podcast. I am your host, Eddie Lindenstein. Joining me today is someone who's been requested quite a bit by the people that listen to this show. I'm joined by Dr. Arlene Feinblatt and Dr. Eric Sherman out of Manhattan. How are you both doing today?
Wonderful.
Fine.
Excellent. Well, so Dr. Feinblatt, in particular, you have such you have so much notoriety in this space. I first came across your name in watching the trailer for the movie All the Rage, which was done by Michael Galinsky about Dr. Sano's life and about TMS and about chronic pain. And the way in which you had talked in some of those, some of the interviews in that movie really, really struck me. But before we get into that kind of stuff, I always love to know, like, what is your background in this field? What led you to work with chronic pain patients? And how did you come across Dr. Sarno?
I was working at Rusk Institute. That was called the Institute of Rehabilitation and Physical Medicine at New York University Medical Center. I was working there, and Dr. Sarno was part of the outpatient department. He was the chief of the outpatient department at that time. And I would report to him regularly, and he was very interested in this idea that much of chronic pain has a psychological etiology. And I was always fascinated by cultural differences in how people react to trauma and pain. And so I was very, very excited to work in this area. And we started in 1973. Dr. Sarno developed the broad program, and I developed the psychological part of the program.
And Dr. Sherman, tell us about you, what your working relationship is with Dr. Feinblatt, and what kind of got you into this topic.
So, as part of the training for a clinical psychologist, in order to be licensed, you need to do an internship, or that was the requirement when I was a student. And I chose to do my internship at what was then called, as Arlene had said, the Institute for Rehabilitation Medicine, because many people I had known had told me it provided excellent training in psychotherapy, which was my chief interest at that time. And when I got there, I was aware that there were various rotations, and one of them was the pain service. And I had always been intrigued by mind-body phenomena, so I thought this was a great opportunity. So I was, in 1984, an intern on Dr. Feinblatt's service, and I worked with her and Dr. Sarno and began the process of learning how to treat these patients, and the rest is kind of history. I've then subsequently devoted my 30-plus year career to treating people with mind-body problems.
And your voice, I got to say, your voice sounds very, very familiar. There's a scene at the end of All the Rage where Dr. Sarno was given a book, essentially like a thank you book with thank you letters in it. Is that you that presented it to him?
Yes, that is me. I presented it with our colleague, Dr. Franz Sommer Anderson. Yes, but that's me.
Yeah. I knew it. And I was looking at your picture, and I said, is that the guy? But no, the voice is what struck me. So that's pretty cool. I'm super fascinated in kind of how this, referral process probably isn't the best way to coin it, but in the days when Dr. Sarno was practicing, and somebody would come into his office and, they would kind of run through his case, similar to what, you know, I told you guys what my background was before we started rolling, and anybody that listens to this on a regular basis knows what it is. But someone comes into his office, they explain their problems to him. They show them their imaging and kind of everything they've been through. And he starts to explain the process to them and say that they get through, because his thing seemed to be, at least in some of the early books, that the majority of people that he saw did not, quote unquote, need to go to psychotherapy, but there was a smaller percentage that did. And so I guess, like, at what point in time did people, or did he tend to refer people out to you and say, okay, like, this person hasn't responded as well as I thought they would to what's in the methodology in the book or working with me, so I want them to work with you. Like, what is that amount of time? Like, what was it? How long did it last? Or were there certain indicators in the person's background or in their personality that would lead him to believe, hey, this person should go see a psychotherapist?
Dr. Sorno was expert at knowing if a patient came in to see him, even for the first time, he was able to glean exactly the kind of person who would not respond negatively to the suggestion that they see a psychologist. And he was expert at picking out the kinds of people who would need that from the get-go. So there were some people that he referred right from their initial consultation with him. Others, and you have to understand that the program evolved. We actually started with an inpatient program, so that was a totally different kind of ball game. But as he progressed and as his thinking enlarged, he developed a series of lectures, and then he developed a kind of group experience for the patients. So for another good portion of the patients, many of them went through the lectures, and then they would be in touch with Dr. Sorno. They might come to a group experience, and he would say, well, if the thing isn't moving quickly enough, he would then refer them to the psychologist.
And I guess how long, let me back up a little bit. You had said usually, like, within that first visit, he could decipher who would respond and who would not. What are some of those indicators or characteristics? And of course you're not him, and we can't ask him, what are some of those traits of people that would come in that he would say, okay, this person will respond? Or what would somebody say or do or act like that would lead him to believe that they would not respond?
Okay, so I'll start, and, you know, if Dr. Feinblatt has anything to add, of course she will. But one of the things that impressed Dr. Sorno is how defensive or open they were to suggestions he would make or observations. So, for example, if he said to someone, that situation must be very enraging to you, and the person would say, no, 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 that couldn't be, you don't, no, no, you have me all wrong, he would say, okay, this person is sitting on a powder keg and probably needs the psychotherapy, but it would not be something that the patient would accept right now. He had an excellent sense of what I'll call tact and judgment, which is part of what made him such an outstanding clinician. Whereas if someone was less defensive and they were able to tolerate the ideas and observations that he was sharing with them, and they expressed distress, like, I'm really in physical pain and it's also affecting me emotionally or the quality of my life, he would kind of sense these people were ripe and would suggest to them that, why wait? Why don't we, just get you started in psychotherapy right now. So it would be his sense that they had distress, but they were able to tolerate it and talk about it and also be somewhat self-reflective. They wouldn't blame other people. They could think about what was going on inside of him. So I think those were the characteristics that he was most responsive to.
One thing that I thought was interesting, and I think a lot of people get snagged on this idea, is he talks about the roots of a lot of this stuff being in childhood trauma. And one thing that I've thought about this well before anything TMS is that I used to think that almost like in order to say that you had quote unquote trauma in your life, that it had to be something major. You had to be sexually abused as a child. You had to have, be held at gunpoint as a child. Like, trauma had to be something big. And then as time went on, that thought kind of evolved, and I started to think that maybe trauma is each to their own. Like, how you interpret trauma, how I interpret trauma, we're both people. We interpret it differently. It doesn't have to be something massive. It seemed like he was very strong in the belief that a lot of this stuff is rooted in childhood. But I always get people that will message me from around the world and say, I had a really good childhood, or I had a great childhood. There wasn't violence in the family. There wasn't yelling. There wasn't a lot of these things that come up on studies such as the ACE study, as an example, but I have chronic pain. I guess, where are you guys at on that thought for people that don't have, traumatic childhoods or things that they can point at specifically, and maybe they sit there and they try and journal and dig and dig and dig. I guess what are your thoughts on helping people that are listening to this sort of reconcile the thought that you don't necessarily need to have this massive type T trauma to be a good candidate for this?
Yes, I think that's a common misperception, that you have to have a trauma such as incest or some sort of abuse or be witness to some sort of abuse. That is not true with the majority. Mm-hmm. In fact, the overwhelming right. numbers of people, and I think you put it very well, it's trauma to the person that's not necessarily trauma that you would read about or trauma that's labeled, this is a traumatic childhood. As you very well put, everybody's trauma is their own trauma, and even when a person doesn't realize or says, I had a wonderful childhood, sometimes there are things in their lives that they wouldn't even recognize as being traumatic, but in fact could be listed as a trauma because of the way it affected them. You don't have to be locked in a cellar to be traumatized. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, people then sort of blame themselves, well, I didn't have that horrible a childhood, why am I having this? Mm-hmm. Which is, it's like slapping yourself for slapping yourself. It's a double whammy. It's not, you don't have to have that kind of experience for it to have affected you in a negative way. I don't know if, Eric, you have anything
else? I would completely agree with everything Arlene said. Yeah. But I would take it one step further. Dr. Sarno wrote over the course of some 30 years, and I think a lot of people were very much taken with his earliest works because they were so profound, but his thinking evolved over the years, and although he felt that early childhood events had a seminal effect on people's adult lives, over time he came to realize that certain life events in and of themselves could be highly disruptive and lead to mind-body symptoms, and similarly, in the beginning, he used to feel that repressed rage was the sole culprit behind all manifestations of TMS. And as he had more experience working with more people, because as he became well-known, a wider range of people came to see him. And he came to realize, because he was an excellent observer of people, that basically it's any emotion that makes you uncomfortable on a private internal emotional level. So it could be grief, feelings of helplessness, fear, fears of sexual arousal, not just anger. So he kind of enlarged his concept of what, you know, was etiologically significant with respect to developing TMS as an adult.
I just want to add one thing. I have found that with a certain proportion of my patients, that a lot of them had learning disabilities. And nobody considers a learning disability a traumatic experience. But for the child, having a learning disability and it not being recognized,
well, yes, yeah,
and it not being dealt with, that can be a traumatic experience in and of itself.
Right. And just to add to that, because what happens is many of these people have failures in school, they feel stupid, they feel humiliated, and at the time this is going on, they didn't know they had a learning disability, so they think there's something fundamentally defective with them, that they just weren't good in school, and they weren't as smart as their brothers or sisters or friends, and this had would have a lingering effect on how they experience themselves as they developed into adulthood. Right. Yeah.
I think that it's interesting. So that's the first time that I've heard that. So I've read, I've read Healing Back Pain 3 or 4 times. The Divided Mind I read, but it was over a very long period of time because I had pretty well grasped the concepts and it became more of study. I always associated the concept of TMS to be anger or rage and a very small percentage, whatever other emotion there could be, whether it be grief or sadness or whatever it is. But you're saying over the years this has evolved. I guess if you were to ballpark, I mean, say that you saw 100 patients, you know, what's the split? How many of these people is that root seem to be mostly anger, rage? How many of them seem to be a grief or sadness? Like what would you say? Because I know that there's going to be people listening to this that'll say, "Whoa, that's the first time I've heard that or thought about it," and they're going to be wondering something pretty similar. If you had 100 patients come in, what's the split on the different, you know, I guess the different emotions that they could be the root cause?
It's very hard to give numbers, but let me just say that an overwhelming number of people do have problems with anger, but there are large groups of people. I'm hesitant to give you a number,
mm-hmm,
but let's say I don't know. What do you think, Eric? 60%?
Yeah,
maybe 60%, 65% would have a problem with anger. It was interesting because in the beginning, when I was, and I can, you know, you remember your first patients the best.
Sure.
Because you're learning the most from them. I had a woman, and I was going on this looking for the anger, and then I realized, oh, my goodness, I'm missing the whole boat here. For this particular person, it wasn't anger at all. It was a deep pathological mourning sense that she experienced and hadn't dealt with. So, you know, when you repress your emotions, you don't necessarily pick out one to repress. Sometimes it has a dampening effect on any kind of awareness of feeling of any emotion. There's a good portion of people who come in and are totally repressed about almost anything, even happiness.
Mm-hmm.
And go ahead, Dr. Sherman.
I was going to say that something I actually learned in working with Arlene is there is a subset of patients who are, I'm going to use a fancy term now, alexithymic, which means that they are unable to recognize their feelings or put them into words. So you will ask someone who is highly intelligent, well-educated, how did that event make you feel? And you'll get, I don't know how I felt. I felt, you know.
Or they'll say, I think I.
Right, yes. They'll intellectualize it. And actually, part of the treatment for them is, one, to recognize that this is the problem and not treat them for a repressed emotion, and help them develop a vocabulary for their feelings. And because if they can't put their feelings into words, they have no other option but to default to put it into body language. So, and that's what children do. That's how mothers recognize their children's needs, by body language. And a mother will say, oh, your tummy hurts, you feel sad. And children learn to link words with bodily sensations and then put their feelings into words. So that's another subset. And I'm guessing maybe that's 10%, 8% or more.
Yeah.
And I would say it disproportionately affects men, the alexithymia. Mm-hmm. You would see it much more frequently in men than you would in women, although women can manifest it as well.
Right. It's a cultural thing. You man up and you don't cry. And
right.
You don't allow yourself. Mm-hmm. But people sort of associate, which always floored me, they always link the idea that if you have an emotion, you're out of control.
Right. Yes,
of
course.
That's the big thing.
Right.
But actually, they're more out of control because they have to keep the feeling bottled up.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not in their control at all because they're not even aware of it.
Mm-hmm.
So our job for many patients is to make them more aware of what an emotion is and give them the idea that that it's okay to have a feeling.
Well, it's more than okay. It's inevitable.
Inevitable,
it's
right.
It's part of being human.
But you're going to wind up dealing with it one way or another.
You know, it's really interesting that you say it's being human, Dr. Sherman saying it's being human, because when I interviewed Michael Galinsky, the filmmaker for All the Rage, one of the things we talked about in the interview is that he did not once use the term TMS once in the movie. And I'd asked him about that because it was something that I had picked up on. And he had said, because I think of it as sort of an unavoidable thing. He thinks of it more as like the condition of being human, which is why he didn't call it TMS, because he says it's humanity, right? Like it's something that's probably going to be unavoidable. When I talk to I always joke with my wife sometimes, where any little thing that can, you know, like her fingernail hurts, something like that, I'll say, oh, you're repressing something, and you know, we get a good laugh out of it. But part of what when people will message me and say, hey, I've got such and such symptom, and I'm like, well, I'm not a doctor, however, you know, just because you don't have back pain, like everybody's kind of got something. And as I sit back and I've done so many of these different interviews with people, and I've read so many of the different books and looked at so much of the data, it truly does seem like everybody's kind of got something, whether it's a, you know, a food intolerance, or it could be asthma, or it could be anxiety. Like, we kind of all have something. And that I feel like, Dr. Sherman, you put that so well. It's being human.
Yes. And one of the things I usually say to people is, if your head is attached to your body, your head is going to affect your body, and your body is going to affect your head.
Right.
There's no way around it.
There was a line that I was thinking about. That there's a clip of you, Dr. Feinblatt, on YouTube, where you're talking about really like it, and it seems very nonchalant and saying, and I know I've watched this clip so many different times, and I'm like, oh yeah, no, I get what she's saying. But I think in the moment when people are, they're back spasming, or their stomach is giving them fits, or they have a migraine, it's really tough to grasp. But you talk about, all we're really talking about, you say, all that we're really talking about here are feelings. When you're intolerant of a feeling, you have no control over it. And it's like forcing yourself to not think that. Can you expand on that concept, this idea of like avoidance and I have no control over it. I don't want to think about it. I don't want to think about it. Maybe just expand on that a bit.
Well, I think a lot of the problem stems from the culture around you, and I think we're getting a little better at that. I see parents now in a schoolyard will say, you know, they'll see a child, their child hitting somebody, and they'll say, okay, I know you're angry, but it's not okay, and you can be angry, but it's not okay to hit someone. When you're not taught that, when you're not given a model of how to deal with your feelings, then you can't allow yourself to even think about them. And when you can't think about them, you are absolutely not in control of it, and it will leak out. It will leak out one way or another, whether it's sadness or anger. Your body will pick it up one way or another, and in that way you're not controlling it, it's controlling you. When you acknowledge the feeling and you're able to talk about it and you give it some air, that's when you can work through the feeling and it doesn't have to result in a physical symptom.
Is there any type of one thing that I always thought was kind of fascinating is one of the examples that Dr. Sarno talked about in his books on when somebody may develop symptoms, it was almost like this delayed onset. It's like you go through this, maybe it's like an extremely stressful time in your life, and then it's almost like there's a lag, like there's a little bit of time passes and then boom, you get a symptom. And that was the one that the first one that I really highlighted in the book when I found it, because for me, like, even though looking back now, I can point at certain things and say, oh, I got reflux here, or I developed a dairy intolerance here. Like, for example, the week after my wife and I found out we were pregnant with our first kid, boom, out of nowhere, I just could not have dairy products anymore, which thankfully is over, because I love cheese and I love ice cream and I love all that stuff. So, you know, thankfully that's gone. But, it was a pretty stressful time in my life, and it sort of went away. And then a week after that, like, the first major symptom, sciatica, bit me. And it was like, what is that psychologically, I guess, when it's almost like the dust settles on an event and then somebody develops symptoms? I mean, what is it that's going on that causes that delay? Because I feel like that's almost one of the more, it's one of the least discussed things in his book, because it's almost like he glosses over it. But to me, at least to me personally, it was a big moment. So, you know, talk a little bit about that. Why the delay for some people?
Well, you know, they talk about people that there's an accident and the parent sees the child injured and rushes to the emergency room. And after the child is under the care of the doctor and the nurse, then the parent faints. Because you do what you need to do to get yourself through the trauma, but you're not dealing yet with the feeling of the trauma. You're sort of in a state of shock. And then, once the feelings emerge, then you have to really deal with them in a different, whole different way.
And I think it's also important to keep in mind that this is adaptive. This kind of delay is adaptive, because if the parent at the site of the accident started to freak out, or the doctor in the emergency room witnesses something that is gruesome, if he or she started to freak out, no one would be able to assist the injured people. So the delay is actually, in many instances, adaptive. The other issue is people expect their emotions to work the same way their bodies do. So if you touch the hot stove, your hand will immediately burn. There will not be any kind of lag. And people try to impose on emotional experiences the same set of rules or expectations that they've developed over time with physical experiences, which is another reason they expect there to be an absolute one-to-one correspondence between the event and the emotional experience, because that's what happens physically very often.
Yeah, yeah, no, certainly for sure. What are some of the more, I guess, prominent, because there was some, as Dr. Sarno's books evolved, you know, healing back pain and mind over back pain, like that sounds to me like it's one of the more predominant. However, in the subsequent books, it seemed like he was talking more and more about other symptoms. In fact, the mind-body prescription, it's like a litany of, he's got like sections. It's almost like my blueprint over the last 15 years is in that book. What are some of the more dominant, I mean, besides back pain, some of the more dominant physical diagnosis or physical issues that you two see in practice, aside from back pain, what are things that people come in with and say, I've had this issue or this place of pain for X number of years, months, whatever?
I think you have to bear in mind that what Eric Sherman just said before, that we're all human. So our mind affects our body, our body affects our mind. Everyone has this issue. But we do see a lot of people with irritable bowel.
Abdominal complaints, yes.
Tremendous. A lot of people are diagnosed with fibromyalgia with no physical findings of any kind. What are they?
Dermatological.
Oh, yes. Huge.
Yes. Headaches.
Headaches, right.
Headaches.
Migraines.
Yes. I would say GI symptoms, skin headaches are the most prevalent.
And you get a lot of people with high blood pressure.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. You know, I'm like, fibromyalgia is a good example because I feel like I see a commercial for Lyrica so frequently on TV. And I mean, I don't even remember what the drug was. There was a commercial last night during some of the election results that, it was the list of side effects that the person reading the script for the commercial, like that took longer than what the benefits were. I was literally counting how many seconds is this person spending on what the benefits are and what problem they're solving versus how long are they spending on the potential side effects. And so one of the things that I have some interest in, personally, but I would bet that other people do, is this idea of like the symptom imperative, meaning that somebody has a physical issue that is solved and then it reemerges as something else. I mean, is that, because I imagine like once you get somebody that comes into your office and starts working with you, it's almost like you have a bunch of snow on a tree and you're shaking that tree and you're starting to kind of move this thought inside of their head and they're going to start getting better. But I would imagine that there's a fair enough percentage that maybe, at least in the beginning, maybe they flare up with something else. Like, you know, back pain goes away, but suddenly their ankle is killing them. Do you experience that on people that come in as this idea of almost like symptom swapping?
A lot of people will do that. But the interesting thing is when Dr. Sarno and I originally started, we tried to follow, there was a program in Washington State that was using what we call cognitive behavioral techniques. And we started to employ them. And very quickly, within a few weeks, we found that this system and symptom imperative became a big part of it. In other words, there's an initial trauma, problem, whatever you want to call it, difficulty for the person. They don't deal with it, and they start to get a physical symptom. And if they then get either medication or they use some other kinds of techniques like cognitive behavioral, they will get rid of their, let's say, their back pain, but then they will develop another pain because you haven't gotten to the core issue of what's causing the physical manifestation, no matter what the physical manifestation is. You really have to get to what the underlying problems are and all the other kinds of... I don't experience that very much in my work in the past couple of years at all. But as I said in the beginning, when we tried to use techniques that were less challenging, we got a lot of symptom substitution. Sorry.
I think that's interesting too, because I'm involved in quite a few like groups on Facebook or online forums where one of the things that I see a lot of people mention is that there's not a TMS psychotherapist anywhere in their area who has a recommendation. I can go see a therapist, or for me it was a cognitive behavioral therapy. It was the first. He's actually the only therapist that I went and saw. Thankfully, he knew all about Sarno's work, had read all the books, and he wasn't trained in TMS psychotherapy. However, he understood the concepts and knew kind of what it was that I was. And I had vetted out a few people, and they didn't have a concept of what it was. Almost like going and doing like an interview session, and they just weren't grasping what it was I was talking about. So thankful to find him. But people that do go and find other types of therapy, I guess what is some of the difference between a CBT approach versus what it is that you do when you say being able to go deal with it in a more challenging manner, more challenging techniques? Like, give me some examples. I guess tell me what some of the differences are.
Well, CBT basically is, I would say, the cornerstone of it is that thoughts influence feelings and behavior. And the way we work, it's almost the other way around, that feelings influence your thoughts and your behavior. And if you think of a common example, I'm sure after your first child was born, wherever you went, you and your wife saw pregnant women and newborn babies. And it wasn't because there was all of a sudden an epidemic of pregnancies and, children being born because you had become parents. But you're now more sensitized to it, and you see it more often because it's so salient to you. So your feelings influenced your perceptions. It's basically why things like Rorschach blots are useful. People looking at clouds, it's their feelings determine their percepts. And the other thing is we... also believe that unresolved issues from the past will continue to influence your behavior in the present, and that you can't think your way out of these situations because they're emotional situations. They're not logical problems. Very often, if these were just logical problems, there are a lot of smart, well-educated people. They'd read a book and cure themselves overnight. But we're talking about emotions, and emotions don't work according to the laws of algebra. You have to experience the feelings. And so our treatment is much more geared towards recognizing feelings and understanding their origin and their impact on your life. And then, an example Arlene used frequently with me and patients when I was in training was, it makes sense when you were a child that you build a fortress to protect yourself, but now that fortress has turned into a prison. So you need to be able to understand how you're living in the past, in the present, and with that knowledge, kind of make corrections.
Yeah, definitely. One thing I almost thought that you were going to go there and steal my thunder on the next question, but didn't go that way. There's a concept. There's two concepts really, in Dr. Sarno's book that I think about frequently. One of those is he talks about like this reservoir of rage. It's almost like to me, you know, blowing an air in a balloon, filling up a beaker. There's a lot of different ways that we can sort of visualize this idea. And then the other thing that he spoke about was the soothe to rage ratio, which I think was first brought up in his third book. But I guess what are some of your thoughts on the idea of people having an overall reservoir of rage? And then what kinds of things can people do to sort of offset I guess maybe balance out this soothe to rage ratio that he spoke about in some of his work?
Let me just say, from my point of view, and I've been, again, doing this since 1973, rage, yes, that's a difficulty, but a lot of people, it's in the rage ballpark, but it's not rage. A lot of people have a problem confronting other people. Now, it's not rage, they're not enraged with the person, but even saying no to somebody, they have a lack of assertiveness, which the problem is that rage covers a multitude of feelings. Not all of them are the typical idea of rage that we have, people yelling or doing some behavioral, you know, dysfunctional type activity. But people have a problem saying no to people. People have a problem even confronting, let's say, a salesperson. That it's still in the ballpark of anger or looking like you're not happy with the person. Rage covers a multitude of feelings like that. Again, it can be a minimal kind of negativity. I think I like the word negativity more than rage. If somebody comes up to me and wants to do something, I don't want to let them down. I don't want to confront them over the fact that I don't want to do it. This is also part of that universe of what Dr. Sarno would call rage. It's not exactly rage. It's more like the ability to say no, the ability to confront another person with something that you don't think they might be happy with you about.
Even to disagree with someone.
Right.
Some people are reluctant to just offer a different opinion because they're afraid, oh, if I have a different opinion from this person, he or she will think less of me, or they won't like me, or they'll pull away from me. And then, of course, you have to ask yourself, because to talk about anger or rage or negative feelings in isolation doesn't really help, because why is this person so important to me that if he or she were to disapprove of me, it would be a fate worse than death, and I'd be willing to do just about anything to avoid it. So you have to look at the relationship of the negative feelings to other ranges, other types of emotions, because they don't exist in pure form by themselves.
And I think that, like, when I was pretty well, like, symptom free right before I had kids, and I think that's one of the things that Sarno talks about in his book, is that, you know, the overall, like, pressure of parenting. And what I think of that sometimes, I think of, like, okay, well, being upset at my 4-year-old for something, or, you know, being angry with her, or not being enthralled with some of the things that she does. Like, well, it's Christmas time, right? So we have these, like, little they're like jelly based adhesives that are supposed to just go on windows. And a couple of years ago, she was sticking them on the walls, and they left these big oil stains. And it's, you know, it's stuff like that, right? But that doesn't, like, being annoyed with her doesn't fit in with the, like, the perfect dad you know, the frame, the Hallmark movie moments that I sort of always envisioned. And to me, like that sounds like it's an example of what it is that you're talking about.
Perfect example.
And, you know, to take it just one step further, it's, oh my God, if I were really a good father, or if I really loved my child, I could never possibly have this feeling. Or if I, maybe I don't love my child enough, or maybe I'm too selfish that I think more about the inconvenience and having to clean it up than my child. So again, these are negative feelings, as Arlene said. They're under the umbrella of, you want to call it rage, or I should say rage is under the umbrella of negative feelings, but they don't exist in isolation, because you experience yourself in a certain way because you have the feeling, and that's a problem. Whereas when you can say, of course I'm angry, kids do things that are annoying and infuriating, and when you can have that feeling without feeling badly about yourself, then you're much less likely to have TMS, because you're not going to have a confrontation with a two-year-old about things on the wall. It's pointless, and the child isn't doing it deliberately. It's no different than a child waking you up crying in the middle of the night because it's hungry. You know, you're not going to yell at the child and lecture the child about being inconsiderate. Mommy and daddy need to sleep. You realize, oh, okay, of course, that's normal. I have the feeling. Anyone would. It has nothing to do with loving someone. In fact, one of the problems I would say we deal with most often is people are afraid that if they have anger, that means they don't love people, or if they express anger to them, they will stop being loved. And I would say, I don't know if that's number one, because there are probably three or four things that are tied for number one, but that's definitely up there.
Well said.
Yeah.
It always makes me laugh. I remember it took me 6 months of CBT to actually say out loud, my child annoys me sometimes. And it sounds so absurd to say now, right? But that's just the way that it was, and the way that it is. I wonder, like, if our 10-month-old woke us up in the middle of the night and I just explained to her how angry it makes us, right, to that she needs to be fed or whatever, the kid, you know, the absurdity of it all. I think that was such a great way of putting it, Dr. Sherman. So we're wrapping up here. I guess I'd love to hear the take from both of you. You know, people listen to this stuff, and you know, some people are on the other side of the earth. I actually had my first batch of listeners from Iraq this past week, which was a surprise to see that pop up. You know, there's people all over the world, and some people in parts of the world, there's not psychotherapists who have been able to sort of grasp these types of concepts, or maybe they're difficult to find. And I always love to get, whenever I have like experts on the line, I love to get some thoughts from them on what are things that people that are, you know, kind of struggling or going through this sort of self-discovery, and they're willing to open the door and listen to it, because anybody that's listening to this podcast is certainly willing to make the leap and look a little bit more introspectively. I guess, what are some things that you would recommend to the commoner? Here's some things that you can do, or maybe think about things a little bit differently, or almost like maintenance for themselves, to be able to you know, start kicking some of these things and be able to not master TMS or master mind-body symptoms, but ultimately just understand themselves better.
First of all, read all of Dr. Sorno's books. That's number one. Mm-hmm. Secondly, I encourage the people I work with to ask themselves during the day, when they have a minute, they don't need more than that, to say, what am I feeling right now? And to get more in touch with your own feelings, you need to do it at odd moments, because you'll necessarily know when you're angry. You'll necessarily know when you're sad. Those big kinds of explosive moments. It's the other moments that people have trouble identifying. So you know, three or four times during the day, if you could say, what am I feeling right now? Not what am I feeling physically, but what am I feeling emotionally? And that's a good way to really get into this process, even without a therapist or the book guiding you. It's just to try to get more in touch with where you are emotionally.
I would completely endorse what Arlene just said for people with TMS and for people without TMS. It's just a good idea in general for everyone, but I would add a cautionary note that if someone thinks that he or she is suffering from TMS, they should not make the diagnosis themselves based on reading or saying, well, I'm perfectionistic and I'm a people pleaser, so therefore my symptoms must represent TMS. You really need to have it checked out by a physician. Now, it is problematic. There are some physicians who will not have TMS in their differential, and they'll tell you there's something, you know, wrong with your disc, which Dr. Sarno used to refer to as gray hair of the spine, that it was normal aging. But I think if nothing else, you need to first rule out serious
Absolutely.
Medical conditions and not just assume it's TMS. It very well might be in many instances, but that's not your place to make that diagnosis.
It's interesting you say that as a good disclaimer, because I agree with you. I, you know, again, like the 25th doctor of mine had pointed more to psychological causes, emotional causes, as opposed to physical causes. But the 24 before that said, you know, thoracic outlet syndrome, or you should have neck surgery, or, and, you know, thankfully, like I didn't go and do those things. I guess it seemed like in a lot of Sarno's work that he talked about, I'm summing it up and I'm very much paraphrasing and simplifying, but basically if you've had it more than, let's say, 8 weeks, because he talks about the femur being 6 to 8 weeks to heal. If it's more than 8 weeks and you've been tested for cancer, tumors, infections, then this is pretty likely is how I would always interpret a lot of his work. Is that pretty well fall in line with what, you know, you two meet somebody at a party and they're talking about Sarno's work, or for some reason they know about it. Like, is that still, does that still hold water now, 2018, all those years after writing those books? Does that seem like it's still a pretty good theory that if you've been tested for cancer and tumors and infections and that kind of thing, that if it's chronic, this is probably what's going on. Do you guys still believe that, or still think that work would hold steady today if he were with us?
Look, when someone calls me, the first thing I say, what has your doctor said?
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, we're not physicians. We don't diagnose. We depend on several physicians who refer to us, who know of TMS and make that diagnosis. It's out of our realm of abilities to diagnose people. And you're talking kind of like about diagnosing through a process of elimination. There are physicians, Dr. Rashbaum, who has taken over, excuse me, Dr. Sarno's, excuse me, practice. There are doctors in different parts of the United States
who
will give you the diagnosis of TMS.
Yes, and you can look on TMSWiki.org. There is a provider directory for the United States. Obviously, it's richer in the Northeast than it is in other parts of the country. But, and there are certain geographic black holes, but people might want to first at least look on that website. And if there is no provider in his or her area, they might call someone in an adjacent area and ask that physician, if he or she knows of someone where that person lives who might have that expertise and could provide that evaluation.
Yes, definitely. Well, thank you both so much. This was a lot of fun. This is the first interview I've done with two people on the other side, so it's been cool. Any final words, I guess, before we hang up on the line that we didn't touch on?
I think one of the wonderful things about working in this area as a psychologist is that, unfortunately, a lot of psychologists have to work with things that they can't see progress. And they some people would say that it's harder for us because we have to see progress.
Right.
But I've always felt that it was one of the greatest joys of my life to have a patient say to me, I picked up my son yesterday and I've never been able to pick him up and hold right. him before. I mean, we are really extraordinarily lucky to have worked with John Sorno.
Absolutely.
And it's provided so much of an emotional reward for myself and I.
Yes, oh, absolutely.
Our patients have taught us a great deal
yes.
about the human condition, and we owe them a great deal of admiration as well as Dr. Sorno.
And apropos of that, I would say, if you have TMS, you're not weak, you're not out of control, you're not inadequate. It's not, if I were stronger, tougher, I wouldn't have it. You have it because you're human, and learn how to be human. This is not, it's not because you're inadequate or defective.
Absolutely.
It's because you're human.
Yeah, great closing, for sure. Well, again, thank you both so much. Really, really appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Mark.